This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Jeremiah Jacques, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I'm filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. We appreciate you tuning in to the Trumpet Hour today, and our panel of trumpet writers are here and are anxious to talk about the biggest news stories of the week. Here in the studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And also in Edmond this week, visiting from Australia, is trumpet writer Callum Wood.
Hello.
Joining us via Skype from our office in the UK is Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And joining us via Skype from our office in Jerusalem, Israel, Brent Noctegal.
Good to be here.
Well, it's now official. On Tuesday, United States President Donald Trump made good on one of his major campaign promises, and he pulled the United States out of the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the Iran nuclear deal. To tell us about this major development, we'll go to our man in the Middle East, Brent Noctegal.
As you said, this was a campaign promise of Mr. Trump coming in and an attempt really to change up the direction that President Obama was taking the country, especially in terms of foreign policy. This was the big moment for him, getting this deal. That is, President Obama and President Trump saw that it was not in America's interest. And so this week he has decided to pull out of it. And the response from the rest of the world has been pretty negative. I would say that obviously the European nations, they wanted to continue to be part of the nuclear deal. Iran obviously wants the nuclear deal to continue. But Mr. Trump, he said this in his announcement. I'll just quote a bit here because it shows that there's more to it, at least from President Trump's viewpoint, than just nuclear containment as well. He says this. He said this on Tuesday. I'm announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal. In a few moments, I'll sign a presidential memorandum to begin reinstating U.S. nuclear sanctions on the Iranian regime. We'll be instituting the highest level of economic sanction. Any nation that helps Iran in its quest for nuclear weapons could also be strongly sanctioned by the United States. America will not be held hostage to nuclear blackmail. We will not allow American cities to be threatened with destruction, and we will not allow a regime that chants death to America to gain access to the most deadly weapons on the earth. And so you can see him linking a couple of things there. What Iran was, as far as this deal, he believes will lead to a bomb anyway because of the sunset clause. They can enrich back in 2025. And so that's a horrible deal. He said they'll find their way to a bomb. Mm-hmm. Plus, we know what they intend to do with it. They chant death to America until they stop having that type of rhetoric and claiming that that's how they'll use a bomb would be foolish to stay in a deal. And so he's decided to pull out. And basically that means is that he will begin again sanctioning Iran with harsh economic sanctions. He'll give a few months for the Europeans to decide what they want to do with that. But he will even sanction other nations and their companies if they do dealings with Iran in these areas.
So in your view, does this actually make it less likely that Iran will acquire nuclear weapons or more likely?
Well, I think at least for the time being, we won't see Iran make any overt, overt plans with their nuclear program going forward, at least for a couple of months. They need the economic windfall that they're receiving from the European nations right now. They must have money coming in. And so they will stretch this out as long as they can do it with the Europeans without looking like they're building a bomb. Eventually, though, even as referenced by the fact that Mr. Netanyahu showed those nuclear files last week, that they had these files in the warehouse, that they in a safe, that they intended to whip them out, that these mm-hmm. plans to continue their nuclear program. I would say this. I mean, their goal is to produce a nuclear weapon at some point. Right now, they need the money, and so they're probably not going to do anything overtly.
Okay, so probably not right away because they still need to keep the European nations doing business with him, but eventually we will see that development. In President Trump's speech, he left the door open to new negotiations with Iran and the other involved powers. And he talked about this time making sure that it was not just about the nuclear program, but also the missiles that would deliver those nuclear weapons and Iran's, its attempts to take over the region there and its state-sponsored terrorism and everything like that. Do you have any speculation about whether a new deal might be struck?
Well, I think he's getting to a point, that even what he discussed with Macron when Macron was in Washington a couple of weeks ago to try and salvage this deal before Mr. Trump left it, they were discussing what other elements would be part of a deal or a new deal. Even Macron had that. The Europeans wanted to put on the ballistic missile, Iran's ballistic missile program onto the Iran nuclear deal. Then they wanted to also add what Iran was doing in Syria onto the Iran nuclear deal. Mr. Trump said this is a deal that was had a foundation of lying, of lies, and so it needs to be scrapped. And then I'm sure Mr. Trump would come along and say, well, let's negotiate a real deal here where you stay inside your own country and stop exporting terrorism around the world. I think this is something that they would try and work towards, but it's something that we've always said at the trumpet that Iran will not submit to. They will not submit to that type of stringent containment on their foreign policy. It's against all of their ideals. It's against the whole desire of the Ayatollah and the Islamic regime, and that is to export across the Middle East and then the world their ideas of life and their protection of Muslims everywhere around the world as they see it. And so even if a deal is struck in the future, would Iran keep to it? I don't think they would keep to that. But I we'll see. It's too early to tell. I don't think we have time really for a whole other deal to be worked out with Iran at the table and all of that. Yeah. The Iran nuclear deal, this took it's going back even to 2009. If you look at the real genesis of it, not even in 2013 when we were told it began, it took years to even get Iran to sign onto a deal that was absolutely brilliant for them. So to try and get them to sign a deal which basically confines them to the Iranian nation, at least inside their borders, I don't think that'll happen.
Could you put this into the context of Bible prophecy for us and just tell listeners where they might go to read more about this prophetically significant trend?
Well, I would definitely, just to zoom out and get a broad picture of what Iran is planning, and all along, people need to read the King of the South booklet by our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flory. It goes into the Iranians' mindset, what the goals of the regime are. It talks about the nuclear deal, why they wanted to develop a nuclear bomb, why they still want to develop a nuclear bomb as well. And so that's something that people should read up on. Bible prophecy indicates that Iran is going to stay a destabilizing factor in the Middle East and the world. It is the one that pushes the world to the brink. That's what the Bible says. So there is not going to be a containment deal for Iran that Iran lives by.
Okay, thanks very much for that, Brent. One place where the Iran deal was not disliked the way it was by many conservatives here in the U.S. is in Europe. And this is not the first deal that the Europeans have seen President Donald Trump lead America away from. We've seen it with the Paris Accords, with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and now here's another major deal that he's walking away from despite Europe's wish for him to leave America involved with. So this has some deep implications for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, for the relationship between America and Europe. And the Europeans are responding to this. To tell us about this story, we're going to go to Richard Palmer.
Yeah, so on Thursday, German Chancellor Angela Merkel once again talked about the need for Europe to separate itself from the US, to go its own way, to have its own military policy. I think she did it in a more dramatic way than I've heard her, an emphatic way than I've heard her ever do before. She said it's no longer the case that the United States will simply just protect us. She said rather Europe needs to take its fate into its own hands. That is the task for the future. And I also think it's significant where she made these comments. So this was in Aachen, the birthplace of Charlemagne, who ruled just a huge chunk of Western Europe. And she was giving this after the French president, Emmanuel Macron, was awarded the Charlemagne Prize.
Hmm.
So he was elected on a really pro-European platform. And he's been, even since then, he's been an enthusiastic spokesman for Europe, for more Europe, for Europe kind of becoming much more like a super state. And you know, because he was in Aachen to receive this prize, and Aachen is in Germany, he kind of used the run-up to that prize to really make an appeal to Germany to do more in forming a strong European super state. You know, he said, we need to do everything to make Europe stronger, more united, more sovereign, more democratic. And he had, you know, like editorials in the key German papers and this kind of thing on the same day making this appeal. So he's in Aachen. He's with Charlemagne's hometown, appealing to Germany to go much further towards a European superstate. And then Angela Merkel gets up and says this. So she's kind of agreeing with him. She's saying, you know, yes, you're right. We want to do more. We need to take our fate into our own hands. And you know, the big reason she's saying for doing this is, well, we want to be separate from the US. It is no longer a case that the United States will simply just protect us. And I think that's a good point you made, you know, introducing it with these various different deals they've seen the United States pull out of. And they were all terrible deals for the United States. The Paris Accord was a terrible deal for the United States.
Mm-hmm.
The Iran deal, a terrible deal for the United States. But Europe loved these deals.
Right.
And so on the one hand, you could say that these deals are kind of causing a break. And in another way, perhaps they're a symptom. You know, Europe loved these deals that really harmed the United States. It shows that there's a break there between Europe and the United States already. But it's interesting. You've got this break and you've got Europe now at least doing a lot more talk about pushing towards more of a European superstate. For example, even earlier this week, Emmanuel Macron had some new announcement where he was getting together a 10-nation coalition that was looking at integrating armed forces more. And you know, a 10-nation coalition always grabs our attention in Europe. We've been saying for years there's going to be a 10-nation superstate in Europe. Now, this isn't his coalition is not the same 10-nation superstate that we've been watching for. Britain is a part of that coalition. You know, the Bible's very clear that half of these nations are going to be from Eastern Europe, half from the West. That's not the case with this coalition. But Europe is moving forward, and a lot of that is motivated by this disagreement with the United States. And you know, this disagreement is something that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has drawn a lot of attention to. I wrote about it in my Trumpet brief just over a week ago, where you had the editor-in-chief of Spiegel, Europe's largest news magazine. He's written a new book, An Obituary for America, The End of a Friendship and a Future of the West. And he basically, you know, his whole theme was Donald Trump is killing America. He's terrible. But then he was also saying, but this is great for Europe.
Right.
When Spiegel online, they wrote an English version kind of based on it. They called it Thank You, Donald, What Trump Means for Germany's Future. And so he talked about Europe being emancipated from America because of Donald Trump. So on the one hand, they really hate Donald Trump, a lot of these individuals. But they kind of feel like we want to be separate from America. We want to be a separate military power. In fact, we've wanted this for a long time. But now Donald Trump is kind of forcing us to separate that way.
Well, we'll be sure to have a link in the show notes to that article that Richard wrote last week, just showing that not only do many in the German leadership recognize that Donald Trump is distancing Europe from the U.S., but also they recognize that that's something that's a positive development, and they're thankful in a way to have him as a catalyst to drive the two apart so that Europe can become more powerful. And Richard, where else would you send listeners who'd like to know more about this trend?
Yeah, another great article to go is one called The Significance of Germany's Break from America by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry. He wrote that back in 2014. That was after the spying scandal where America was caught spying on Germany. Obviously, some of that news is kind of a bit old news now. But once you get beyond the first couple of paragraphs, it is all bang up to date. I mean, Mr. Flurry wrote in that. Most Americans don't realize how violently our allies are condemning our foreign policy. He talked about, he said, what makes this German and American split especially important is this. It is exactly what Bible prophecy told us would happen. And then in that article, he takes you through Ezekiel 23 and very specific promises about the way America would build Germany, build Europe up, and then Europe would break from America. And with these disagreements with the Iran deal, with Europe saying we need to go our own way, we can't stop that, we can't rely on America anymore, you're seeing that break now in very concrete terms. So that article, The Significance of Germany's Break from America, by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry, is a great place to get the prophetic background on this story.
Well, thanks very much for that, Richard. Well, here in the United States, there are also plenty of people who disagree with President Trump's decision to exit the Iran nuclear deal, especially among the supporters of President Obama. And in one very sobering case, a highly influential individual is even secretly working to undermine President Trump's decision to exit the deal. To tell us about this and just about what it means for the integrity of the so-called United States, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, in a bombshell announcement, the Boston Globe broke the story that former Secretary of State John Kerry actually went to New York 2 weeks ago and met with the Iranian foreign minister in an attempt to strategize ways to keep the Iran deal in place. Mm. And the same report mentions that before he did that, he'd also met with several European officials, including the German foreign minister and the French president, to discuss the same thing.
Does he even have a position in the U.S. government right now?
No, no. He was, John Kerry was Secretary of State in the Obama administration.
Right.
And so he has some gravitas in the effect that he's kind of widely looked upon as representing the official foreign policy of the Democratic Party.
Yes.
But he has no position in government to actually make policy.
But that didn't stop him from flying around and meeting with various heads of state.
No, and there are those calling for him to actually be accused of illegal activity under the Logan Act. That's an act passed in 1799, which makes it illegal for private citizens to try to conduct foreign policy. Hmm. Now it's also 1799. It's an older act that's never been enforced before. So that's probably unlikely that any charges based on that act will be brought against him. But the bigger angle here is it just kind of shows how the strategic division that's undermining American foreign policy.
Yeah.
Because we talked on this program earlier in the year how last year, actually same thing with John Kerry, also with no official government position at the time, met with a key advisor to the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, telling him to hold out against President Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. And there were a few more leaks from that meeting, because that meeting he's actually telling the Palestinians, he says Trump won't be in office for long. As a matter of fact, there's a good chance that he could be out of office a year from now. Hmm. Like inferring to like an impeachment or something like that.
Right.
And there's no leaks as to actually what he's told the Iranian foreign minister, but kind of along those same lines is that's the angle John Kerry has been taking, is he doesn't hold in a position to actually negotiate, but he can tell you, well, Trump won't be president forever. It's the United States. You usually swing from a Republican administration to a Democratic administration to a Republican administration to a Democratic administration, in which case you can just keep doing this forever, where the Democrats pass an Iran deal, the Republicans take it back. The Democrats pass it, the Republicans take it back.
It really does seem like every 4 years we have these wide oscillations of foreign policy. I mean, we've seen President Trump exit the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the Paris Accords. He's demanding new terms for NAFTA, and now the Iran deal. Like, this does seem like it would send a message to the world powers that it's not really a stable or a predictable nation if you have a new administration, you know, every 4 years, who's going to reverse right. everything that the last guy did.
And that's all John Kerry can do. He can meet with the foreign minister of Iran and basically just tell him that I can't make policy regarding the Iran deal, but I can tell you that the largest political party in the United States, the Democratic Party, is against this. Mm-hmm. And so a future administration could reinstall it if you hold out long enough. And that does really make it hard for like U.S. allies, like probably one of the nations that has the most to lose from a nuclear-powered Iran is Israel. And so if you're Prime Minister Netanyahu trying to look to the United States as like your friend and ally, but I mean, for 8 years under the Obama administration, we were not a friend and ally to Israel, and now we kind of are again, and I'm sure they're thrilled about that. But then when you've got Secretary of State from the previous administration telling a different story, it does make it hard for an ally like Israel to make plans for the future. And we just wanted to highlight something here is there's actually a prophecy in Micah just describing the conditions in end time Israel. And anyone who's listened to the show for any length of time really will know that when our founder Herbert Armstrong wrote in his most popular book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that America and Britain are literally the end time descendants of Israel. But this prophecy in Micah is talking about Israel or America, Britain in the end time, where the description he uses starting in Micah 3 and verse 2 says, "The good man is perished out of the earth, and there is none upright among men. They all lie in wait for blood. They hunt every man his brother with a net, and they may do evil with both hands earnestly. The prince asks, and the judge asks for reward, and the great man, he utters his mischievous desire, so they wrap it up." So he's talking about this internal division where brother is against brother, and even like the great men and the politicians are doing mischief and things that benefit themselves but not the nation. And that is really a very poetic and sobering description of the United States today, where you've got brother against brother, levels of division that university studies have quantifiably measured are worse than any point since the U.S. Civil War. And great men or prominent men like John Kerry, who once held a high position in the government, who's undermining the policies of the United States and just exacerbating that division more and more.
Well, we'll be sure to have a link to the United States and Britain in Prophecy in the show notes there. And it really does do just an astoundingly powerful job of showing what the United States is going through, and just how rapidly our demise is happening and what's fueling that demise. Thanks very much for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. And most of the stories and books that we're discussing today are up on our website, thetrumpet.com, or they'll be up there soon if they're not yet. So please visit thetrumpet.com to get more information on these important stories. We're going to take a break in just a moment, but first we'll cover one more story that shows just how vulnerable the United States may be becoming in its near abroad because of Chinese activity. To tell us about this, we'll go to Callum Wood.
Yes, China is buying control of the Caribbean. They're buying up alliances, and they're doing it through economic incentives. Now, this is very important to America, as you mentioned, because a lot of America's seaborne trade does travel down through the Gulf of Mexico into the Caribbean. And the latest friend of Beijing, you might say, that's been bought out is the Dominican Republic. Now, the Dominican Republic, on May 1st, a financial advisor for the Dominican Republic, he came forward and he announced that the country was shifting some of its policy. And it was appropriate that it was a financial advisor who gave the announcement because the decision was entirely financial.
Yeah.
The Chinese have, apparently, according to Reuters, the Chinese have offered a $3.1 billion package of investments and loans in exchange for the Dominican Republic changing its stance on Taiwan. Now, jumping across to Taiwan and to why this would happen, well, Taiwan has very few allies in the world, those who recognize its sovereignty. China, on the other hand, has worked feverishly to make sure that it has plenty of people or plenty of nations, you might say, that support its stance that Taiwan is, in fact, simply a rogue regime, a small state that's broken away that does belong back in as a part of China.
Yes.
And so the Dominican Republic was one of those nations. A lot of the nations that do support Taiwan are smaller nations, and Taiwan generally gets their support through economic incentives as well, but it simply can't compete with China's economic incentives. They just have too much to offer.
Right. By many measures, China now already has the largest economy in the world. So it's very difficult for Taiwan, although they are a powerful economy, they're still not even a shadow of what mainland China is.
Absolutely. And I mean, the Dominican Republic, a very poor nation there. They certainly they need those sort of incentives. But there's a broader problem here than Taiwan's problem is small by any stance. But as you mentioned, the broader danger is for America, because what China's doing is it's buying up control of these nations. It's influencing their foreign policies. And it's such a critical area there. Only, I think it was 2017, we saw Panama made the same shift in policy towards Taiwan.
Right.
And Costa Rica before that. Mm-hmm. And so what this is showing is that China's just has all this economic leverage that they're bringing to bear in the region, and it's right on America's doorstep. And China is certainly growing as an economic power. And the trumpet we cover China's role in Bible prophecy and what's about to happen on America's doorstep. There are very specific prophecies that Mr. Gerald Flurry actually points out and talks about, and in relation to China and an economic siege of America. He has a great article that I would recommend people read. It's called China is Steering the World Towards War. And in this article, he explains this economic siege that's coming. And I just have a quote here from it. It says, Bible prophecy describes a time of great tribulation, an end time period of suffering on a scale never experienced in human history. And he references Matthew 24:21, Daniel 12:1. And he says, many other scriptures show that the nations devastated the most will be America, Britain, and the Jewish state of Israel. In the past, we've believed that this tribulation would begin when these three nations were attacked militarily. Ezekiel 4, however, describes the tribulation as beginning with an economic siege of these nations. And readers could go back and read Ezekiel 4, verses 1 to 3, but I especially would just recommend going back and reading that full article by Mr. Flurry found on thetrumpet.com. That's China is Steering the World Towards War. And here you can just read in detail about how China is going to be allying with other nations in an economic war and an economic siege of America. So when we see nations, even small impoverished nations like the Dominican Republic, they're falling deeper into China's pocket, you might say, more and more influence being exerted there by Beijing, just points towards the fulfillment of this prophecy. China's just building the framework for it, getting the groundwork laid, along with Europe and the other nations that are going to be involved.
And we'll be sure to have a link to that article, China is Steering the World Toward War, in the show notes. And Callum has also written an article about this specific Chinese influence in the Dominican Republic. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes as well. Thanks very much for bringing us up to speed on that, Callum. You're listening to Trumpet Hour here on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial. And the live stream is available anywhere in the world if you just type kpcg.fm into your internet browser. Coming up, we're going to talk about Israel striking Iranian targets, Italy's new Eurosceptic government, China's tightening grip on Australian sea lanes, and what's behind California's move to ban certain books and services. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
This is Jeremiah Jacques filling in for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. Israel said on Thursday that it had hit nearly all of the Iranian infrastructure inside of Syria during airstrikes. These are Israel's biggest strikes inside Syria in more than 40 years, so it's a very significant development. And to talk about this, we'll go once again to our Jerusalem Bureau and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this was an absolutely massive attack by Israeli planes and also surface-to-air missiles or surface-to-ground missiles as well, shot from Israeli territory, Israeli artillery from the Golan Heights towards Syria. And as you said, there was a lot of Iranian infrastructure that was targeted. 50 sites, 50 Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps sites were targeted all over Syria. 20 jets in the sky operating in over hours. And this was something that was in retaliation, actually, to the Iranians. The Iranians fired 20 missiles from Syrian territory. This is the first time, actually, that Iran has struck out against Israel with missiles. for decades. And so that's why Israel was very concerned about this. Obviously, Israel had been planning for this for some time. Operation Checkmate or something like that, Operation Chess, is what the preparation for this attack was by Israel. This operation was called Operation House of Cards. And so for Israel, it's kind of a red line for them that they do not want Iran to set up shop in Syria. And so they use this action by the Iranians firing 20 missiles into Israel. Four of them got shot down by the Iron Dome system, one of Israel's defensive measure system in the Golan Heights. Mm-hmm. And the other 16 landed in Syrian territory, didn't make it across the border. Mm. But nevertheless, this is a dramatic increase in the seriousness of what's going up on in Syria. Iran and Israel are technically at war right now, not even through a proxy. This is direct nation against nation fighting that we haven't seen before. So this is definitely something that people should be watching.
So Iran and Israel are at war, but could you talk a little bit about how a war between these two has the potential to spiral quickly into a greater regional war and possibly even something larger?
Well, Iran's proxies are obviously at work inside the Syrian regime. The Syrian regime's a proxy of the Iranians. You have Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. Hezbollah currently has 6,000 fighters fighting inside Syria on behalf of the Iranian regime, really. They answer to IRGC Quds Force leader Qassem Soleimani. They don't even answer to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. So you have on the Lebanese side of the Israeli border towards the north, all of these Hezbollah fighters with 140,000 missiles there that are able to be tapped at some point by the Iranians to start firing on Israel. You have them. You also have Iran that could increase its support for Hamas in the Gaza Strip as well. Today, we've got another march of return taking place. Thousands of Gazans, Hamas-led, are on the border with Israel trying to sabotage the border, cross over to Israel, and that's only going to increase up to May 15th next week, attack day for the Palestinians. That is going to follow the day after the United States embassy moves. So a lot of things are brewing. But as far as what Iran can do, I mean, they can use Hezbollah, they can use Hamas, and they can use the 50,000 soldiers that they have fighting for them inside Syria right now. That doesn't include the Syrian regime forces. That doesn't include the Russians. That is just people that answer directly to the Iranians. So there's a massive ground force that is there. Whether they want to do that right now, we will see. They haven't told Hezbollah, unleash your missiles on Israel just yet. I think they're probably waiting a little bit to see what happens with the nuclear deal with the Europeans. If they did start a full-on incursion into Israel against Israel right now, this moment, then you would likely see the Europeans come down pretty hard on them on this, which is not against Iranian interests. So I don't know if that'll happen just yet. Nevertheless, the situation, the status quo is maintained. Iran might be set back by a month or two in Syria, mm-hmm. but you still have Iran on the border of Israel, even after these attacks from Israel against them.
So you don't see this as something that would drastically weaken Iran's presence in Syria? It's just a temporary setback?
Yeah, it's a temporary setback. Israel has said this set them back for 2 to 3 months. That's all. And so that is a little bit of a breather. It shows Iran that they're serious on their red lines, that Israel has said that we will not accept an Iranian presence inside Syria, mm-hmm. especially not with game-changing weaponry that can hit us. And so when they did fire some of that weaponry, Israel attacked. I think one important thing with the events that have transpired over the last couple of days is the fact that Russia did not intervene, that Russia was told about these strikes that were coming against the Iranians by the Israelis, that Benjamin Netanyahu was in Moscow on Wednesday, a day before this attack took place, talking to Putin. And so I think the fact that the Russians could have intervened but didn't, basically gave Israel the green light to do this, indicates that there might be some fracturing between the relationship with Russia and Iran inside Syria. I think that's one of the main takeaways that people can see from this.
Could you place this in the context of Bible prophecy for us, and also just tell listeners where they might go to read more about this?
Well, there's a couple of things one main thing that I'd like people to read. It's an article that's written back in 2008, 10 years ago, and it's entitled "Iran Conquered Lebanon, Now What?" It talks specifically of what happened in Lebanon back in 2008, but it's very important because just this week also, we didn't get to it, but Hezbollah, this terrorist group that Iran directly heads, and Hezbollah says as much, they maintained their position inside the Lebanese government, and their allies actually extended the seats inside the parliament, which has now given Hezbollah basically a majority inside the Lebanese government. They haven't had that yet. And so Iran's position right now, even though it took a hit inside Syria, is still very strong inside Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, and in the Gaza Strip. And so Israel is attacking, yes, but people still need to be watching for Iran, what they will continue to do going forward. Bible prophecy indicates that Iran's goal is Jerusalem, and they are going to get so close to taking it, probably through one of their proxies, at least East Jerusalem, that Israel reaches out for help and support of a peacemaker that has to come in and broker terms. And that will be the Europeans, interestingly enough. And so Iran's goal for Jerusalem isn't going to be diminished. This is definitely something that fits into biblical prophecy. Whether they get it through their actions in Syria or not, that might not be the case. But the way Iran is pushing for Jerusalem, this is definitely something in line with Bible prophecy.
And we'll be sure to have a link to "Iran Conquered Lebanon, Now What?" in the show notes. Well, thanks very much for bringing us up to speed on that, Brent. Italy has been in political deadlock for months. After three failed rounds of consultations, it looked like Italy was either headed toward a caretaker government or maybe even toward fresh elections. But now a couple of notable parties have taken some major steps toward forming a new coalition government, which has some big implications for the European Union. To tell us about this, we'll go to Richard once again.
Yes, Germany and Europe are facing their nightmare scenario now in Italy, just about the worst possible outcome from their point of view from these coalition negotiations. So you're having now the Five Star Movement and Liga, or the League. It looks like these two parties are going to be able to move forward now and form a coalition. And they're two quite different parties. The Five Star Movement they're a kind of a brand new party founded by a comedian, Beppe Grillo, in 2009. They've not been around long. You could generally describe them as left-wing, but they're kind of so radically different from what we're used to, it's hard to categorize them. Basically, they just want a new political system. They've used like online polls to come up with their decisions. They've called for a citizenship income. They want all citizens to be guaranteed about $1,000 a month as long as they're working or looking for work.
Wow.
That's obviously quite popular, especially in the poorer South. Mm-hmm. And then the Liga is very different. They're kind of this fringe right, sometimes even called far right party. They used to be called the Northern League, campaigning for Northern Italy to split off from the West. They've dropped that, and they've campaigned on a much more anti-EU, anti-migrant ticket, calling for mass deportation of migrants from Italy. And they're now Italy's largest right-wing party. So two different parties, but the one thing they both have in common is they hate the EU. Hmm. You know, the Liga doesn't like migration, that it's kind of liberal, political correct type of policies foisted on them by Europe. The Five Star Movement wants to be able to, you know, print money, borrow money freely, this kind of thing that the Eurozone clamps down on. So they're very different, but they agree on that. And because they're very different, it's been very hard for them to get to this point. The big sticking point has been Silvia Berlusconi, because Liga went into the Italian elections in a partnership with Berlusconi. And after the elections, they insisted, look, he was our partner. They were kind of loyal to him. You know, we went into elections with coalition with him. If we're going to be in a government, Berlusconi's got to be in it too. Otherwise, we're not interested. And this has been a huge sticking point for the Five Star Movement. You know, they want new politics. They're anti-corruption. And so on Wednesday night, Berlusconi backed down and he said, I'm not going to stand in the way of a government. You two parties get together. And it looks like they're going to do that. And people are saying they're probably going to do that very quickly now. And that it looks like you would have a new EU government. And the big thing that they agree on, that they can take action on, is that they hate the euro. Both of these parties basically ran on a ticket of kind of, well, they've both talked about quitting the euro in the past. They kind of thought, well, that's a bit too radical. People are kind of scared of that. So they ran on a ticket of keeping the euro, but ignoring all of the rules that Germany's kind of imposed on the eurozone, and then just basically telling Germany, well, what are you going to do about it? You know, try and make us keep them. So they're talking about ignoring EU's debt limit rules. They've talked about even perhaps introducing a parallel currency that they can print. The Liga leader, Matteo Salvini, he's called the euro a crime against humanity. So, I mean, you can see what they think about this. And so you can see why this is almost the biggest headache imaginable for Germany. They're in this horrible – they're in this coalition that they're barely holding together, where they disagree on the euro even within the coalition, and they've kind of barely papered it over. And now you've got – and then now you've got Italy coming along and basically saying, well, we want to use the euro to siphon – to, you know, the way the Germans would see it, siphon off Germany's money, and we're going to kind of dare you to stop us.
So European unification is one of the main prophetic trends that the Bible says will happen in the end time. So this development in Italy almost seems a little bit counterintuitive, at least with what we are expecting to happen there with Europe drawing closer and more unified. How does this Euroscepticism, how do you anticipate that playing out in a way that moves prophecy forward?
Well, Bible prophecy does say Europe's going to come together, but it says the Europe that comes together looks very different to the Europe that we see right now. We mentioned even in the first half of the show that we're expecting a Europe made up of 10 nations. Europe right now, if you include Britain, is 28. When they're gone, 27. So we're looking at a very different Europe, and one that's much more closely coordinated. So how does that happen? Well, that implies, even though you've got such a big change, some kind of crisis. And well, you look at what people like Jean Monnet, this kind of Europe's founding father, he said Europe will be forged in crisis and will be the sum of the solutions adopted for those crises. Herbert W. Armstrong had this great piece back in 1965, and he was saying, look, we've been saying that Europe's going to unite. We've been saying this for 30 years, even back in 1965. It's not happened. And he said, look, yeah, I understand human nature. Germany is not going to just voluntarily do whatever France wants. France isn't going to voluntarily do whatever Germany wants. This is why Macron's proposals haven't gone anywhere so far. Germany doesn't want to go with a French vision for Europe. And so he said, well, yeah, they're just going to keep arguing. They're going to keep having these troubles. But he said it can't happen until there's a crisis. And Mr. Fleury said exactly the same thing. He said throughout Europe's history, what has helped it overcome its division has been a unity of purpose between church-state. But he says this church-state union hasn't always been a happy marriage. Usually the two have been drawn together because of a crisis, an emergency. And he wrote, Herbert W. Armstrong believed the same pattern would occur again in our time. The European nations would unite suddenly because of a crisis. And so we're looking for some kind of crisis, and Italy trying to quit the euro, that could very well bring about that crisis. I mean, Italy is a G8 nation. They're not like some tiny economy like Greece.
Right.
So, you know, we are watching basically for Europe to have some kind of earthquake. I mean, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has even speculated you could kind of see the European Union fall apart and have this new European power kind of built or rise quickly out of the ashes, built from the pieces of that. So Revelation chapter 17 talks about this 10-nation power led by a woman, led by a church. So some big changes ahead. Daniel chapter 2 makes similar forecasts. You can read our free booklet, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy, that will give you all of those details and go through and prove that. But it will take a crisis to bring that about. And that's what we see in Italy could be that crisis. If not, what we see in Italy shows us the potential for those crises just to keep on hitting Europe until they get this kind of a union.
Well, this is a major development. We really appreciate you putting that story in prophetic context for us, Richard, and we'll be sure to have a link to the Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy in the show notes, just so that the listeners will be able to understand what the Bible says will happen with Europe in the very near future. Thank you for that. All of the stories that we're discussing today, or almost all of them anyway, are published on thetrumpet.com. Please visit there to check these stories out and to subscribe to our free print edition and our free email news briefs. Well, China is growing more and more assertive and aggressive in its foreign policy. Last week, we spoke about advanced weaponry that China has illegally deployed to its artificial islands in the South China Sea. Many analysts say that these weapon systems and China's southward expansion in general could give Beijing the capability to project power far south of the South China Sea, even into Oceania. And many in the Australian government are extremely concerned about their increasing vulnerability to China. To tell us about this, we'll go once again to our panelists visiting from Australia, Callum Wood.
Yes, there is a grave concern, especially this past week, that Australia's fuel levels are too low, our reserve fuel levels. There was a report that came out very recently that spoke about how vulnerable we are to influence from abroad, especially from China, as a lot of our imported fuel does come down from the north. Just as some of the facts that we have at the moment, Australia has 4 refineries left at the moment. Considering how much fuel we do produce, we only have 4. In the last 10 years, 3 very large refineries have been shut down in Brisbane, Sydney and elsewhere. So we're down to just 4 refineries. We import 75% of our crude. 55% of our refined products are also imported. So liquid fuels that we import, that includes petrol, diesel, jet fuel, and that accounts for about 37% of Australia's energy use and 98% of our transport needs. So access to fuel from abroad is very important to the Australian economy. And at the moment, we like you mentioned, we're seeing China increasingly asserting itself in the South China Sea. And while Australia is trying to diversify where it gets its fuel from, it is very subject to wars and influences from abroad. For instance, the Middle East, we might try and diversify and get our crude and our fuels from multiple nations. But unfortunately, when wars start to happen and supply lines get cut off, it doesn't matter if it's 2 or 3 nations. If it all comes through one sea lane, then right, it's all cut off. And the same problem applies in the South China Sea. We get quite a lot of fuel from South Korea. Malaysia is one of our largest. And so as China is starting to dominate the region and certainly extending its influence down further south towards Indonesia, we even heard last week there was rumours of China setting up a base in Vanuatu, of all places, which is right on Australia's doorstep. So if they were able to influence and to disrupt the flow of oil through that region, Australia's economy could be brought to its knees very quickly. And that's starting to be realised by some. The government itself has talked about increasing its holdings. We're supposed to have under certain deals that have been struck with the International Energy Agency and such, we've struck deals where we're supposed to have 90 days worth of fuel in reserve, and Australia currently at the moment has about 50.
Wow.
Which is very, very small. When you think about it, if trade was to be disrupted in any way, if the tankers stopped, we have about, I think on an average day, there are about 45 oil tankers en route to Australia each and every day, and that they carry about 20 days worth of fuel. But if they were to be impeded in any way along that journey from whichever nation, let's say China, for some reason we upset them and they stop those boats in their tracks, which they could well do now that they control so much of the South China Sea.
Yeah.
If they were to stop that, I mean, you'd have the fuel that was in the tank of your car, and that would certainly be a worry for the everyday person. But you would think very quickly fuel has to be diverted for things like food, restocking shelves. The military, I heard one analyst just the other day talking about how, well, it would only be a matter of weeks before our entire military would be immobilized. Especially considering jet fuel, which is harder to come by, and our stocks of it are quite a lot lower, our military could be crippled very, very easily. And so Australia has started to take some steps to try and rectify this. Over the last 12 months, we've entered into binding agreements with the United States and the United Kingdom and others who would provide us with fuel in the event of an emergency. But Australia is part of this International Energy Association, where we're supposed to be able to contribute to other nations that might have shortages. But as we can see at the moment, Australia is incapable of even holding the stocks that are required for the bare minimum.
Could you put this in the context of Bible prophecy for us and just tell listeners where they might go to read more about this trend in its prophetic context?
Absolutely. Well, going back to what I was speaking about earlier, the same prophecy applies. When we're talking about economic siege in America, well, that also applies to Australia. Not a lot of people know, but Australia is in the Bible. We do have a place as part of Ephraim, and so the prophecies there in Ezekiel 4 that we discussed earlier, talking about an economic siege, do apply to Australia as well as a part of the nation, the descendants of Israel. So if listeners wanted more on Australia's role on the world scene in prophecy, I'd encourage them to go back and to read the same book that was mentioned earlier, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, and that can give the reader certainly a lot of insight into what's coming in the region. If they wanted to know more about China's part in all of this, certainly is our Australia's biggest economic partner at the moment, but also one of our biggest threats, they could certainly go back and read Mr. Flurry's booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy, which would be a great place to start there, and just gives a great overview and even a lot of depth into what China's doing and how that's going to be impacting Australia, Oceania, and of course all of United States, Britain, and the world.
Well, thanks very much for that, Callum. In California this week, lawmakers set in motion some extremely controversial legislation that, if passed into law, would be a dramatic infringement on First Amendment rights. To tell us about this development, we'll go once again to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, there's building concern in California that this bill could be interpreted broadly to even ban books. Now, it's currently under consideration by the California Senate, and if it passes the Senate and is signed by the governor, it will become law. Mm-hmm. It was passed by the California State Assembly on April 19th by a vote of 15-18. And the bill would ban reparative therapy, or basically any good or any service aimed at helping someone overcome gender confusion or same-sex attraction. Mm. It's been pushed through the state assembly, saying that this is a fraudulent practice that's trying to convert people away from the sexual orientation they naturally are, even though there's no science that shows that sexual orientation has a genetic basis, or that homosexual or transgender orientations have a genetic basis. They're psychological conditions that develop after birth. Even though they're saying that this bill would only apply to counseling sessions, the text of the bill itself talks about banning goods and services where any financial transaction takes place. So broadly interpreted, because the Bible speaks against homosexuality, that could be a good that if a financial transaction took place, like selling a Bible, a lawyer in the future could come in and even ban that based off the text of this bill.
Wow.
Not likely to happen in the short term just because of political backlash, but this is something where you're just kind of like laying the groundwork under the pretext that, well, we're just trying to ban therapists from charging people for counseling and how to overcome same-sex attraction.
Right.
But raising it in a way that in the future you could see First Amendment rights cracked down on, where you could not sell books, Bibles, ministerial counseling services, or anything that would help someone overcome gender confusion.
Wow. Well, that's a really sobering possibility, especially in light of the First Amendment there. Could you place this in the context of Bible prophecy for us?
Well, just in the context of moral decline, I mean, we've mentioned the United States and Britain in prophecy a couple times this program, just showing that there are prophecies that morality would be in decline in the end time. But we also have our book Redefining Family that you can request, that will explain in detail exactly what the Bible teaches about family and sexual orientation. And why things like homosexuality are wrong, and why services like the Bible and ministerial counsel on problems like that are so vital.
And we'll be sure to have a link to Redefining Family in the show notes. So please check that out if you've not read that very important booklet. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Please visit us there to read more about the stories that we've discussed today and to subscribe to our print edition and our news brief, which we send out several times each week. I'm Jeremiah Jacques, filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Tell us what you think about the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Andrew Miller, Callum Wood, Brent Noctegal, and Richard Palmer.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a pleasure.
Great to be here.
Thanks also to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And we'll leave you today with the words of Holocaust survivor Viktor Frankl. Let us be alert. Since Auschwitz, we know what man is capable of. And since Hiroshima, we know what is at stake. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.